This is Bill Meehan, recorded at the Bass Club reunion in Cardiff by Chris Alden Lee on the 13th of June 2010. Bill Meehan, Part 2.
Take me through then, if you wouldn't mind, Bill, your side of the story of this escapade. What was the first time that you had any concerns?
I would say late in the day, when there was no sign of them. I'd assumed they'd be... They went in the morning, I'd assumed they'd be back afternoon. They were, it wasn't as if they were collecting penguins' eggs or anything like that. They were going to take photographs and have a look at the rookery, you know, their first big rookery they'd seen, or for some of them anyway. And I told them that there was a depot at this place, at the beach, below the rookery. They'd find a big chest and rock with rocks around it and perhaps on it, and in there they'd find a primer stove and all sorts of goodies, food, fags, you know, essentials in those days, weren't
matches.
They? Yes, they're all primus, I think, yeah. Anyway, they did, and very welcome it was too, and they spent the first night there, and we thought, well, that's okay.
Why couldn't they get back? Why couldn't they get back?
Because a storm blew up. The weather changed totally. Somewhere in the mid to late afternoon, the time when they would have been coming back, a storm blew up, and they decided it would be safer for them to stay where they were. And they knew about the depot, they found it. All that side of it worked well. And so we expect them to be back the following morning, but it wasn't very nice weather then. There's still quite a wind blowing. And Lofty and I, had informed Stanley, of course, as soon as the party was missing. But we knew where they were. There'd be no sign that they'd left that beach. And although we couldn't actually see them. But the following day, Lofty and I set up a theodolite so that we could look at an upside-down picture for... as I say, it's about 7 miles away. We went a bit further up the hill behind, and suddenly there they were. Suddenly the dinghy was in view. They pushed off from the shore, but instead of coming this way, they were going out towards what ultimately would be through the mouth of the bay and out into the Bransfield Straits. So we watched, and from time to time they'd disappear below the waves, then up again, we'd be relieved, oh, they're still okay. And then we lost sight of them, and we reported this to Stanley. So say they were on the high sea, it looked as though they might be in danger, but it's fairly narrow there. I can't tell you how narrow the entrance to Admiralty Bay is. It's narrow if you come through it on a ship. In a dinghy, you've probably got, you know, could be a mile wide for all I know. But there's another beach there in the... If you imagine this bay, they are just over in another corner of it. And the following day, we saw a smoke fire there and reported this to Stanley. And Lofty and I had been... Now, I tell you, I was quite a tough young man, and I was used to travel, and I could walk up mountains and things like that. Lofty was a very experienced mountaineer, rock climber and everything. And he'd already given me some introduction to rope work. In the week or so that he'd been there before this trip. And he and I were thinking about the only way we're going to find them is to go over the glaciers and right the way around, because they were on that beach and they were putting up smoke signals. Well, we hadn't got all the right gear, for one thing. I think Lofty had got one climbing rope. We didn't know the way. We didn't know the best way. But, you know, we would have worked it out. So we could have done it. Lofty was pretty certain that the best way was to go clockwise rather than anti-clockwise. And I'm sure he was right. But we got a message from SecFid, who didn't tell us the Navy's on the way, don't worry. He just said, do not take any action to rescue them. Do not leave base. Stay with the radio and stay put. And that's what we did. He also told us to paint a sign way up on Flagstaff Hill that said, stay. S-T-A-Y. I think we got the S the wrong way around. Not that it mattered. They didn't see it. At least I don't think they did.
That was a difficult order to...
Orange paint.
That was a difficult order to obey, wasn't it? Sit there, do nothing.
Yes. Oh, those were our orders. We did what we were told, and highly relieved we were that we didn't any longer feel obliged to make that journey.
So the Navy arrived, did it?
So then I think I was told in a coded message that the Navy was on the way. They were out there somewhere or other. I think it was the Varian Bay, I'm not sure. Plus a sloop were out there. But all that we saw was a midshipman with a motorboat who towed their dinghy. I think they were in the motorboat. The dinghy was empty behind them.
Had the dinghy motor failed?
Oh, yes. The outboard motor had failed constantly. They were in... They weren't in a bad state. They looked as though they'd been on a rotten... long journey over the hills and far away for a week or so. Very dirty and smoky, sooty, you know, from primer stoves. You can get a bit sooty from a primer stove.
So how were they returned to you?
Sorry?
How were they returned to you?
As I say, I had very little discussion with
them. How did they get back to the base?
They were towed in by a Navy midshipman who gets sent out in motorboats by the Navy. Go and find these chaps. And he found them right away, where we said they were, where we'd last seen the smoke, where we'd last seen them. And they were about to make another attempt when the Navy arrived. In a way, they were somewhat disappointed. George Hammond told me later, they were a bit disappointed to be rescued by the Navy. It was a bit humiliating in a way, because they were quite all right, and they would have got back as soon as the wind dropped. And yes, that was the theory. But they were very subdued.
Did base practice change after that, in any way?
I don't know, because I wasn't there much longer, but I was due to go. I had to go to Port La Croix. But as for base practice changing, I think there might have been a lot more emphasis to make sure that parties had radios with them.
Towards the end of your FIDS career, you found yourself in the middle of a royal event, didn't you? The Spithead Review.
Yes,
of 1953.
Yes.
Tell me the story behind that.
Well, that was very exciting, really. As we were coming up the Atlantic, first of all, we had a signal that we were to get home in time for the Spithead Review. The Biscoe had been its name, not its name, but its title changed. It had been formerly the survey vessel John Biscoe, and henceforth was to be known as the Royal Research Ship John Biscoe, which sounds very grand, doesn't it? and same boat, of course, same old tub, but anyway, and was and we were all invited to the ship's crew, and all the FIDs on board were invited to attend. And we, the idea was all this depended on the ship getting home by some magic date, which might have been the 6th of June or whatever, I can't remember now. The Spithead Review takes place after the coronation, you see. About a week after, and I can't remember when that was. So there we were, rolling up the Atlantic slowly, 12 knots on the way home. And the command was that we were all to be provided with uniforms. Now, the ship's crew, some had jerseys and some had jackets, you know. And we FIDs, including me as the radio officer, we got our peak caps and sort of like a petty officer's uniform, I guess they all were, blue jacket, blue trousers, black tie.
A tie?
Yes. We had to buy our own shirts. Ah, yes, I remember now. We arrived at the docks in Southampton a day just in the nick of time to enable us to have a long weekend at home. We were all released for a long weekend to be back here by Sunday night for the Spithead Review on the Monday. Now, I may have those days wrong. It could have been some other days of the week, but it was a bit like that. So we had a couple of days, rushed home for a couple of days, bought a white shirt for the occasion and a clean handkerchief or two and that sort of stuff. And then back on the Biscoe for the thing. And I remember calling the ship was that was in charge, that we were just casting off and would be coming out to take up station, John Biscoe, you know, and getting the acknowledgement of that. And then I heard we were being called by a yacht out there somewhere or other, as we went out to take up our position in the line. This yacht called me, and its name, I should remember to this day, was Serendipity. I had to look up in the dictionary what Serendipity meant, and it's a very good word, actually, and a nice name for a yacht. So that's why I've remembered them. They just called me up to say we wanted the privilege of speaking to the famous John Biscoe ship.
Anybody famous climb? Did you meet anybody?
Oh yes. We had various people came round, but notably Scott. I've forgotten his Christian name.
Peter
Scott, the son of the famous Captain Scott. And he made a point of coming on board and stayed with us for some time and chatted to everybody. And he was very well known. There were other people whose name long escaped me. And then, of course, we had the inspection where Her Majesty comes round, our new Queen, crowned a day or two before, but appointed about a year before when her father died. She, dressed in blue in the royal barge, came down the line of ships. And we were debating before she came about the taking off the caps and how you stand with your cap here. All this was explained to us. We must have doff our caps and go, hooray, 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 and then keep your cap off until she's passed. and whether we should say hurrah or hooray. And there was two schools of thought there, and the word went round. Well, you say what you like, you know. If you're a hurrah chap, say hurrah, and if not, say hooray.
Let's just look at one or two other details before we part, because mm-hmm. we have an appointment to go to. Health and safety was primitive in your period down.
Yes, yes.
Down in the Antarctic. You say here that FIS might not have existed had health and safety been more stringent. What do you mean by that? Some of the things we did, you say, in FIS would probably be considered rash today, but then we worked on a shoestring. And had we not done so, it seems likely that FIS might not have existed.
I think there must have been a strong possibility of that. I think the whole organisation was run on a relative shoestring. If you think about it, most of the equipment was second-hand. Nothing wrong with that, and it worked, and we got by with it. I don't think the income to the Falkland Island government, and that's where they were the ones responsible for kitting FIDs out and all that sort of stuff. I don't think they could have been all that handsomely reimbursed in those days for the whaling dues. I don't know. I don't know how much they got. I don't know the economics of it. But that was my impression. Now, I know there was at the time a lot of criticism of Frank Elliott. And I've no reason to believe that the criticism wasn't correct. At the same time, I think he had a very tough job to do in organising this without a lot of staff, very, very few staff behind him. And he will have been given a budget to work to and told, well, when that's gone, there's no more money. It must have been like that. I can't believe it operated any other way. A lot of Antarctic expeditions in the old style, of course, operated on people like Shackleton calling for funds and got grants from the Royal Geographical Society and a lot of money subscribed by rich people and so on. And you had to have money to do it. And I don't think we had an awful lot, because Britain was in a state, with the time we're talking about, those early 50s, much as we are this year. There was no money. It was obvious to me in everything we did in the army that we were operating on a tight budget.
Do you feel that health and safety was compromised by that lack of resources?
Oh, no, it just hadn't been thought about. There wasn't any health and safety. I believe that health and safety was a very good thing when they started imposing it on building work and so on, construction generally. And that's where there were enormous number of deaths every year in the construction industry. People killed and maimed for life. No safety belts, anything like that. Car accidents, seat belts, that's another one. See.
Let's finish you one little story about a radio spoof that you were involved in, the great South Sandwich Island wireless spoof.
Yes, I'm quite proud of that. I'm not sure whether I invented it or Jeff Collop, who was a very good friend of mine at the time. I met him on the day we joined FIDS, or came for our interviews. We came at the same time and were both interviewed by Frank Elliott in the morning, and then you had to go off and do other interviews. And we went out at lunchtime together and had a sandwich somewhere or other and a beer and wandered in the gardens and... We decided there must only be one vacancy, and so we were rival candidates for it. And Jeff told me about this expedition to the mountains of the moon in Africa, or somewhere rather. He thought it might be Africa. And And I said, well, if I don't get this one, perhaps I can apply for the Mountains of the Moon one, you see. But fortunately, they wanted at least two wireless operators, so we were both taken on. But Jeff was at Port La Croix, so I saw him again later. And the spoof was, to get back to the point, that the South Sandwich Islands, although part of the, in those days, Falkland Island dependencies, and presumably still part of British Antarctic territory, were unmanned. There were no people there. I've never been to them. I can't tell you anything about them. But there being nobody there didn't matter to us. We decided that we would have a base on the South Sandwich Islands. Now, I'd got this pack set, or one of the base pack sets, that I used for emergencies, from when my main transmitter wasn't working for some reason, or we couldn't start the diesel engine. I had this little pack set beside my bench, always there as an emergency if the main radio doesn't work. So one day, apropos of nothing at all except the Jeff Collett Bill Mean spoof plan, I called myself up from this station that was in the South Sandwich Islands, or other people said it was. I gave myself a ZHF-33 or whatever the number was, I forget, whatever, and called me.
By Morse.
By Morse, you see. And I answered it, and then I've got one message for you. And I sent myself one little message about something or other, and I acknowledged it, you see. And then this chap, Kelly, who just arrived in the Argentine Islands, I didn't meet him there and never have done. He called me up and said, who was that then? What's ZHF-37 or whatever? And I said, well, that's the South Sandwiches. Oh. We said all this in Morse to each other. And so it sort of blossomed from that. And I got, at every time we did an observation, and all the vases would call me and send in their obs by Morse, and the South Sandwich one would call me. But it was me with my left hand on the other key. Completely different sounding wireless note. And I tried to disguise my...
And so you were sending Met Obs from the South Sandwich Islands?
Yes, to myself. They never went to Stanley, of course.
What was the weather like in South Sandwich?
I have no idea.
And how long did this ruse
go? Oh, some weeks, till we got tired of it.
It wasn't rumbled then?
Yeah.
Was it rumbled, or...
I don't know. I don't know in the end of what Kelly thought. I think the word got round, you know, it is a spoof. The other bases knew, of course. They knew there wasn't anybody. So they would have told them. And I expect Kelly told his mates in Argentine Islands, you know, I got this station in the South Sandwich Islands. Is on the hookup now, you know? Yes.
It's been a real pleasure, Bill. I'm sorry we haven't got more time. You have a lunch to go to, but thank you very much indeed.
Yes. Thank you.